Last hour, we were entering the last 7 days of Jesus' life. 7 of the 16 chapters in Mark are devoted to the last 7 days. From what we celebrate in our church year as Palm Sunday to what we celebrate as Easter, what we call Holy Week. And it begins in chapter 10, if you have a Bible in front of you, chapter 10, verse 46. Myers suggests that these last 7 days begin with a couplet. This is reviewing a little bit from last time. The couplet consists of the story of Bartimaeus, the blind person who was healed. All of these references to blind people being given their sight and deaf people being healed, Myers is saying is part of the gospel telling us to wake up, to see, to hear. Those who have eyes, let them see. Those who have ears, let them hear. And it addresses the fact that the disciples are just not getting the message. They're not able to understand. And even to the very end of Jesus' life, they don't understand. They don't comprehend what it is that's going on. What Jesus is doing is so radical, so different from what they have been raised on, just as Myers is giving us a point of view, so different from what we've been raised on, that they cannot accept it. They cannot understand it. There's too much turning around of the head that has to happen for them to be able to get it, to understand. And the Bartimaeus story has Bartimaeus addressing Jesus as son of David, which is another way of talking about the what? The Messiah. The Messiah was to be the son of David, to usher in the golden age, great empire, to take over, destroy the Romans, give Israel its independence again under a great king. That's the image that the Jewish people had in their mind. It's the image that Jesus has to reverse, has to turn upside down. And then in the next story, a story of Jesus riding the donkey of the procession, once again, the people around call him what? The king, the coming kingdom of our ancestor David. David's kingdom is going to be restored now. In both cases, what we have is the orthodox traditional understanding of Messiah announced by these two people, in these two stories. And that sets up the plot for what's going to happen through the rest of the week. What Myers calls the paradoxical messianic symbolics. Interesting expression. Right. After the procession, Jesus enters the temple 3 times on 3 successive days, staying overnight in Bethany, not in Jerusalem, but in Bethany. The first time he comes in, and in chapter 11, verse 11, to our great surprise, all he does is look around and then leaves again, which is a commentary on what that procession was all about. If that procession had been that great, glorious, kingly coming of the Messiah, we would have expected that Jesus would have come into the temple and take over, you know, and rise to glory. But instead, Myers says, if you read very carefully, Jesus doesn't even enter Jerusalem in that parade. But he enters Jerusalem after the parade is over. And it's so anticlimactic, nothing happens. Nothing. Nothing happens. The Messiah doesn't come to glory at all. And Myers thinks there's an important message in that. Then he goes back to Bethany and comes back the next day to the temple. This time, what does he do?
Overthrows
the money changers and those who are selling doves. As I mentioned last time, Myers thinks that it's important that those two people are mentioned specifically, those two classes of people. Because the money changers were the ones who were reaping the profit. It was the people who were selling doves who were dealing with the poor. Only the poor had to rely on doves to make their sacrifice. The rich could bring their own animals, and usually they brought a more decent kind of animal, like a lamb or a calf. The poor bought the doves, and they were the ones who were exploited. Meyer says, Jesus pits himself against the temple system, not only because it's the religious establishment of the day, but more importantly because it's the economic power in Jerusalem. It's like Washington State University is in the town of Pullman, the biggest payroll in town, and the most important economic reality in that town of Jerusalem. And very, very exploitative. I'm not saying Washington State University is exploitative, but the temple was very exploitative of the people, and particularly the downtrodden, the poor. That's what he's pitting himself against. So it's an economic reality, more particularly than it is a religious reality.
They're often connected, right?
They're very much connected, yes indeed. What's happening here is startling to the Jewish people, of course, because to attack the temple is to attack God from their perspective. God lives in the temple. Then he goes back to Bethany and returns a third day, and this time he's in confrontation with the temple authorities. One story after another. We won't go into all of these. Confronted on the issue of authority in chapter 11, 27 and following. He tells the tenants' parable, which the Sanhedrin, the leaders of the temple, very quickly understand to be a parable addressed against them. They get the message. They clearly understand. And they want to arrest him, but they are afraid of the masses. Over and over again this week, the authorities are afraid of the masses. The Herodians in chapter 12, 13 and following, who try to trap Jesus on the issue of taxes. And the peasants were very often abused by the tax system. And this peasant community is raising this whole tax issue, because that was part of why the Civil War was happening. The Jewish people were so burdened by taxes. It's sort of like the American Revolution that started because of the tax issue, taxation without representation, you remember, and the Boston Tea Party, and all of that stuff. Taxes very often are the underlying issue in a civil war, and that's part of what's going on here. And Jesus seems to be put in an impossible bind by the questions that are being asked. If he says, don't pay taxes to Caesar, then he becomes a political enemy of Rome, more clearly and overtly than he wants to be. And if he, on the other hand, says, pay taxes to Rome, then he's going to alienate all the peasant people who are abused by that system. So he turns the question around, as he often does. And he really doesn't answer the question for them. He throws it back at them again for them to think about. And we've been thinking about that for 2,000 years, how we relate as church and state. You've heard this text preached on any number of times around those kinds of concerns. Then in chapter 12, verse 18 and following, the Sadducees raising the question about resurrection. And they bring this absolutely absurd example. Though it's an example that's in keeping with Jewish protocol, that if a man marries a woman and he dies without children, then his next younger brother is supposed to marry her, and if he dies without children, then the next younger brother is supposed to marry her. If he dies without children, the next younger brother marries her, and Jesus in effect is saying, this is stupid. I mean, what a dumb question you raise. That's never going to happen that way. But he says the most important problem with the question is the way in which it talks about the woman involved. This poor barren woman, and a barren woman in Jewish society was looked upon as under a curse. If a woman couldn't bear a child, she was in some way cursed by that. It was an indication that that God had some problem with her. And there's no concern given about the welfare of this barren woman in the questions that the Sadducees raise. She's just passed along like a piece of meat in this process. And that's Jesus' objection, Myers is saying. And again, symbolizes the way in which, as we've said before, throughout the gospel, there's a paradox between the greatest and the least. The least become greatest, the greatest become least. Or the first become last, the last become first. The first-last paradox running throughout the gospel. We've seen that earlier in the gospel for those of you who are new. The elevation of women who were in that culture much, much more oppressed than they are in our culture. Believe it or not, women, they were. You may feel oppressed in our culture, and you are, but certainly more in that culture than in ours. And the whole notion also that runs through that question, that the progeny of a marriage is through the male side, and the inheritance concept that's tied up with that. You see a whole system that Jesus is pitting himself against. So they raise this abstract theological question about resurrection, and Jesus brings that question down to earth, to where people live and the way in which we are oppressive of one another. Myers calls it a political reading of Mark's story of the life of Jesus. Then when we get to the 35th verse of chapter 12, Jesus turns that whole entrapment thing around and tosses a question back to the authorities, who think they've got him cornered. And Myers suggests that the way he frames that thing about the Messiah being the son of David is to say the Messiah is not going to be the son of David. He's simply pulling the rug out from under the whole traditional Orthodox Jewish way of looking at the concept of Messiah. Just pulling it out from under them, as if to say that's a wrong-headed notion. That is not the way it's going to happen. The Messiah is not going to mount the throne and become the king like David was. And that, we just can't imagine how radical that was for those people. They simply could not comprehend that. That was too much for them to understand. Then in chapter 13, we come to the second major sermon in Mark, the only lengthy exhortation from Jesus in Mark, which is a much more activist gospel than the other three, is one. The first is in chapter 4, which we looked at earlier in the week, and now this chapter, chapter 13. This chapter is usually interpreted as Jesus talking about the end of the world, and in apocalyptic or eschatological language. And those who preoccupy themselves with figuring out what the end of the world is going to be all about and set down this will happen and then this will happen and then this will happen. Are you familiar with terms like dispensationalism and post-dispensationalists and pre-dispensationalists and a-dispensationalists? They all have a different way of understanding the calendar of the last days. And Myers is saying this chapter's got nothing to do with the end of the world. It's got nothing to do with the end of the world. What it's talking about is all of the turmoil, the war that was taking place when Mark was writing, the civil war that's going on and the horror of that. And it's once again a call to the disciples to be true and faithful and to stick together and to see that process through. And it's going to be very dreadful. It's going to be very tough.
Isn't the same true of Revelation? That's really about that situation there, not about the COVID.
Well, I believe that, yes.
I just heard Marcus Ward, New Testament scholar,
right,
say that the new current thinking, that, the notion that Jesus was primarily eschatological is now being sort of rethought, that maybe that the message wasn't as focused on the end time as.
Well, as you know, there's been so much talk about that. Hal Lindsey's book and
right.
A lot of the TV evangelists get into this stuff. And
well, they turn the Bible into a kind of code book
yeah,
for deciphering.
Right. I saw a car, I was behind a car one day that had a sticker on it that said, when the rapture comes, the driver of this car will disappear. As though if this car veers off into the ditch, the rapture's happened and Smith is left behind, but this person got to heaven. Well, that's what they're implying.
Yeah, sure.
If you're still around to read the bumper sticker, you missed the rapture, right?
Well, like you were saying, that's a current form of exploitation.
Yeah.
Of people's
yeah.
fears.
For sure, yeah. Yes. Scare people into heaven. You know.
That's it.
Yeah, a lot of hell talk. And preachers really think they can manipulate people into believing that way. And I just think it's not very helpful. I don't know how in the world we talk about this. Just sitting with my mother, who's 93 years old recently, on my way out here, and her twin sister, who is also 93 years old. they got into this conversation, not because I was doing Mark, but it's sort of part of the conversation. Oh dear, you know, the world is terrible. Things are awful. We must be in the last times. All these earthquakes and these floods, of course, talking about the Mississippi River, and all this oppression, and the kids are all going wrong. They're all on drugs. You know, it's this somber, grim look at the world. And we're certainly in the last, and I say to Mom, look, hey, come on. It's always been that way. It's always been that way. There's nothing new in that. There's nothing that's happening now that hasn't happened before. And every time there's been a great time, like in the Middle Ages when the plague was going and people were dying by the tens of thousands from illness, people believe this has got to be the end of the world. And when war comes, First World War, we've never had a world war in the same way, or the Second World War around the globe, people were predicting the end of the world. When the year 1000 rather, came, people thought this is the end of the millennium, and they pulled out Revelation and all the thousand-year language, and this has got to be the end. Hey, look, when we approach the year 2000, we're going to hear the same stuff from the same crowd that are sure that on New Year's Eve, zingo, this will be the end. And the next morning, they'll wake up and see the sunrise, and they'll be so surprised it didn't happen. So we've always had those people. The Millerites, if you know in American history, William Miller, who gathered all of his disciples around, and they paid all their bills off, and they made friends with all their enemies, and they are getting ready for Jesus to come. They go up on top of a mountain, and Jesus doesn't show up. So then Miller sits down with his computer and works out another formula and comes up with another day, and they do it all over again. Jesus still doesn't show up. But they still continue. They're called Pentecostalists today, who have that view of history that you know, somehow it's going to end with a bang. It started with a bang. It's going to end with a bang. I suppose history will end, you know. And if history's going to end, there's hardly any argument with the idea that we're getting closer to it. Obviously, we're getting closer to it. But that doesn't time it. It doesn't put a calendar together for us. And I'm not going to sit around and worry about that. I'm just phenomenally disinterested in the whole subject. I know that the end of the world comes for Verlin Smith the day that Verlin Smith dies. That's the end of the world for me. That's the eschatological reality for me personally. And for any of us, and we will all have that experience someday, quite likely. There are twice in the Gospel of Mark where Jesus says that all of this is going to happen before this generation passes away. And that's been a real problem in a biblical interpretation of those two passages. Like, what did he mean when he said that? Well, I think he meant exactly what he said. It's going to happen before this generation passes away. And it did indeed happen. The temple was destroyed. And from the standpoint of Jewish religion, that did look like the end of the world. It did look like a cosmic judgment upon their life. That the temple, the very presence of God, was removed from them. That had to be the end of the world for them. in a very important sense. It did happen before those people died. Thank you. I really agree with what you're saying. And Myers, of course, takes that point of view very clearly. In this chapter 13, there's an angle on this that I have not seen before reading Myers' interpretation, and that is that he suggests that this Markham community that we've been talking about all week, committed to nonviolence, was experiencing the effort on the part of the Jewish patriotic nationalist forces that sought to overthrow the Romans through civil war, that they are continuously seeking to recruit people from that Markham community to join the army. The Navy and Marine recruiters are out there with the young men who are part of that community, urging them to act on their patriotism to protect Israel, Judea, temple, protect all of this that's our life against those Gentile Roman intruders. Join the army and do that. Get into God's army. And of course, what Mark is saying, that is not how it's going to happen. That is not the way it should happen. Think back to the war in Vietnam and the people who the conscientious objectors, the people who saw that war as not virtuous, but as an evil. And of course, we were sharply polarized in our country over that issue, and we still are. The way in which the Bill Clinton thing worked out, and during the campaign, where in an important sense, we refought that whole polarization around the Vietnam War. And Myers is very clearly committed to nonviolence, clearly committed to the idea that the will of God is not promoted through military power. And let's face it, folks, virtually every war that we've been a part of during my lifetime, and that goes back to the Second World War, every one of these wars has been looked upon as a kind of holy war. That we're on God's side against some great evil. And we mount that cause not only as patriots, but as people of God, and see warfare as the way in which we will, if not advance the kingdom, at least hold off those people who want to destroy the kingdom. And that whole notion of holy war is as old as the human race, and we see it here, Myers is suggesting. And what Mark wants to do is to make very clear that that is not the way in which God's will be worked in the world through the use of violence. The revolution happens from beneath as the mustard seed, which grows automatically. You don't force that process through power and violence. If you try to do that, all you do is replace one oppressive system with another oppressive system. And you have the same kind of situation in the future that you had in the past. People are still oppressed. Marginalized people are still oppressed in the same way that they were, or perhaps not to the same degree necessarily, but in very much the same way as they were under the previous regime.
There's independent evidence that supports that there was a lot of that going on during the final battles, this recruitment. I think it might have been from Josephus, right?
Yeah, right. That, he picks up on that.
People were streaming from all the provinces into Jerusalem.
Yeah. You're referring to some of the study you've made of that period among Jewish people. Yeah.
Even Essenes.
Among the Essenes as well. What Myers said is that Mark, like Jeremiah, are you familiar with the prophet Jeremiah? When the city of Jerusalem was under attack during Jeremiah's lifetime, all of the other prophets prophets, quote unquote, were saying to the king, what we got to do is ally with this group and work this way, and then we'll be victorious, and God will protect Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And Jeremiah says, it's not going to happen. Jeremiah says, Jerusalem's going to fall. Well, suppose during the Second World War, we had preachers going on television and saying, the Nazis are going to win. They'd be in very great difficulty. And Jeremiah gets tossed into a dry well, you know. Get rid of this naysayer in our midst. What we got to do is rally the troops of this enemy that's attacking us. And Jeremiah was seen as unpatriotic, as subversive to that effort. And what Myers is saying is that that's precisely where Mark is as he writes this tract. And he sees his community and himself as seen, as looked upon by the majority culture among the Jewish people who are rallying around the civil war. They become the enemy.
Do you think that the Gulf War was a perfect example of a holy war? I mean, we were doing a jihad. I mean, literally, you turn. And of course, the economics underneath were there too. The oil was the really economic factor.
Yeah.
But and then you get, you know, the number one holy man, Billy Graham, to give his blessing.
You know. Yeah. At the same time as George Bush's bishop was demonstrating in front of the White House against the war. So he ignored his bishop and brought Billy Graham into the White House to advise him on military matters. That's a very, very interesting scenario, if you think about it.
Yeah, it was interesting, but Penn Wright was saying that in Bozeman, you know, the day before the war, there was a huge rally, and it was still okay to have division, but once the bombs started dropping,
it stopped.
That shrunk.
Yeah.
It was no longer okay.
The ALCA bishops came out against our using military in Iraq. Herb Chilstrom wrote on it. He was in a press conference. And as soon as the bombs started dropping, there was no more talk from our bishops about it. We were silenced completely. And the problem was that we could not distinguish between supporting the war and supporting the troops who were in the war.
The tragedy is, of course, it was the people who paid, by and large, who, against whom we said we were not praying against the people, but against the, obviously Hussein,
yeah,
has some bills to pay, so
yeah,
somewhere along.
Yeah. Well, you realize you're saying terrible stuff.
I mean, that's why I'm from the Golden Village.
you're talking a language that our society doesn't understand. And that's what Mark is talking about. I mean, that's what Jesus is talking about. We Christians are called upon to be radical disciples.
Well, that's what I think. I mean, that's...
Yeah. And that is not always acceptable behavior, even within the church, unfortunately. Maybe particularly within the church. Jesus, in his visit with the disciples, is saying he will be dragged into the courts. Does that sound like conscientious objectors? You'll be dragged into the courts. You'll be required to make your case. He tells them, don't worry about what you'll say in advance. You'll be given a way to talk in that situation. Myers says, whoever stands in solidarity with the way of Jesus will be universally despised. I wonder if we really believe that. Whoever stands in solidarity with the way of Jesus will be universally despised. And the sermon ends with, wake up! Come on, get with it, gang. And that takes us right into the Garden of Gethsemane, where the disciples don't wake up, they fall asleep. These sleepy guys, you know, sleep through the most important drama that this planet has ever known. I often wonder if I'm not asleep when a lot of wonderful miracles are taking place in the world. We're taken now to the Last Supper in chapter 14, verse 12, following. Here Myers again gives us, I keep calling it an alternative interpretation. By that I mean it's something different from what I've at least been schooled upon in the past. he suggests that the whole business of the supper was planned in advance when the disciples is told, go and you'll find a man carrying a jar of water. Meyer says, men didn't carry jars of water in those days. Women carried jars of water. So this man would be a signal. This is a safe person. We undercover subversives can trust this guy to find us a safe house where we can have our supper together, our last supper. And they're directed to this place and the preparations have been made. And then, says Myers, an interesting twist happens. And that is that Jesus is really not celebrating the Passover in the way a good, faithful Jew would. Notice there's no mention of a lamb in that whole story. And the lamb is central to the Passover. You know, remember that back to the Exodus. There's no mention of a lamb in this story. I'd never noticed that before. There's no mention of a lamb. So Meyer says, Jesus takes this traditional Jewish observance that every devout Jewish family will celebrate every year. Celebrate's not quite the right word, but commemorate every year. And he turns it around as if to say there's a new kind of myth. And don't misunderstand that word. Myth does not mean it's untrue. There's a new kind of reality that's coming into place now. To quote Meyer's words, instead he is expropriating the symbolic discourse of the Passover in order to narrate his new myth, that of the human one, or Son of Man, not Messiah now, but Son of Man, who gives his life for the people. Again, the concept of Messiah is being reworked even in that supper incident. And then he immediately announces his own fast, that he will not eat or drink until the time of his death. And he predicts, you will all desert me. Not only will Judas betray me, not only will Peter deny me, but you will all desert me. This community that's been put together so carefully is going to fragment, is going to dissipate, and as of course it did. In the Garden of Gethsemane, the disciples sleep through the prayers, and then the crowd comes with swords and clubs. Meyer says this reeks of the overkill, so typical of covert state action against civilian dissidents. One little unarmed guy and you bring a whole bunch of armed soldiers to apprehend this one little guy under cover of darkness because they were afraid of the masses, right? And then Jesus points out the absurdity of that. And he says, you come like you're looking for a robber, a bandit, an armed person. And Meyer said, this is the first time now that Mark uses that word robber, which is the word that he associates with this armed revolution against the Roman authorities that have been trying to recruit people. And Jesus now says, you're treating me as though I were part of this armed insurgency against the government, as though I was one of the robbers. Remember, he's talking to Roman troops here. These are armed soldiers. And the ironic twist in the story, Myers suggests, is that when we get to the trial before Pilate, before the Roman authority, Pilate tries to trade one person for another. Who was it? Barabbas, huh? To trade Barabbas and Jesus. And Barabbas was one of those armed insurgents. So Jesus gets into the mix where he's been trying to resist being all the time. And then the irony of ironies is that when he's crucified, there's a robber on one side and a robber on the other side. Again, Jesus is crucified as one of the armed insurgents. And Myers makes the point that that's why Jesus was crucified. He was killed as a political opponent of Rome. He was perceived to be a political opponent of Rome. Crucifixion was not something Jewish people did, it was something the Romans did. And it's something they did against their political opponents. There were lots of crosses around, lots of bodies hanging on crosses all over the place. And they were political opponents, held up as a deterrent against other people taking up arms against Rome. And that's the way Jesus is perceived, and that's why he dies. You've got a political reading in what Myers is offering us. Then you have this strange little insertion in verse 51, the young man who runs away naked, leaves behind his garment. Myers does an interesting twist on that I want you to see. A traditional way of seeing that verse is that this may have been Mark who's saying, I was there, I was a witness, and what I'm writing is something I learned firsthand. But he too runs away, and maybe he's kind of ashamed of that when he writes this gospel. Myers doesn't deny that possibility, but what he does is to make the connection between this young man, the term in Greek, and the other place where that term appears, and that is at the tomb when the women come on Sunday morning. There's a young man who's sitting there who tells them to go to Galilee because Jesus, tell the disciples to go to Galilee because Jesus will meet them out there. And the term linen cloth that he leaves behind is the same term that's used at the tomb, the linen cloth that's left behind. So you have, in Myers' imagination, this is the young man who now is naked, who at the tomb is clothed in white. He's clothed in the garments of the martyr. This young man runs away lest he be clothed in the garments of the martyr. The young man who's at the tomb is fully dressed but clothed in the garb of a martyr. Play with it. Interesting, imaginative kind of connection. That's not something I've ever been told before in my study of Mark.
Well, if Mark has all these other symbols in it, why can't that symbol be in it too?
I think it's great. Yes, indeed. Lots of symbolic stuff going through this gospel, as Myers understands it. Then you have the double trial, the trial before the Jewish authorities and the trial before the Roman authorities. Myers believes that the Jews could well have executed Jesus if they wanted to. Usually, it's interpreted that the Jewish authorities turned Jesus over to Pilate because they didn't have authority to do capital punishment. Myers doesn't believe that. He thinks he calls it a political cartoon. He thinks this whole trial is written down in such a way as to make the point that here are the two major forces against which Jesus pit himself. And both of those major forces now impinge themselves upon him. And he does a very interesting analysis of the way in which these two trial stories are told and sees very much similarity just in the way they're narrated. He has a column where one trial and the other trial, and you see how closely related they are. In front, the trial in front of the Sanhedrin, or the high priest, has the priest ask Jesus, are you the Messiah? And in the New Revised Standard Version, the translation is, Jesus says, I am. Now, if that's the case, it's the only place in Mark where Jesus identifies himself with the term Messiah. Now, Mark identifies Jesus with the term Messiah in the very first verse of Mark. But we're seeing how that term is being reworked. Myers thinks that that's a mistranslation, of Jesus' response. He thinks it ought to be stated as a question. Are you the Messiah? That Jesus' response is, am I? Not I am, but am I? And sees that as Jesus' mockery of the whole trial, of the whole system. Just as in the trial before Pilate, when Pilate asks him the same question, are you the king of the Jews? That's Messiah, right? Are you the king of the Jews? Jesus is stone silent. He doesn't say a word, which is terribly upsetting to Pilate. Again, Jesus mocking the Roman authorities, mocking the Jewish authorities, mocking the Roman authorities. Which brings us to the crucifixion itself. Myers does an interesting thing where he looks at Simon the Cyrene, who is forcibly recruited to carry the cross. Think of the symbolism. Myers suggests Simon becomes a disciple against his will. And just as Jesus had said to the disciples, you will carry the cross, take up your cross and follow me. Now Simon is taking up his cross. And he says, the whole story of the life of Jesus is framed by the name Simon. The very first chapter of Mark, who's the first person called to be a disciple?
Simon Peter.
Simon Peter. The very first in chapter 1, Simon. Now at the end of the story, another Simon. You got Simon on both ends of the story. And both of them involved in the issue of discipleship. And Simon Peter, who's been his disciple all the way through and has been the leader and the responder and the one who always had something to say, has denied Jesus and run away, and the rooster crows, and another Simon moves in and carries the cross in his place. And this Simon is a Gentile. This Simon is a Gentile. I get goosebumps when I think about that reality. Huh? Isn't that marvelous? And then Jesus is executed between two bandits with the inscription on the cross that you are the king of the Jews, you are the Messiah. Even the Romans use that word in that way. Ah, we're running out of time. I just want to say that Myers takes the story of the centurion and Joseph of Arimathea, who claims the body of Jesus, interprets them in such a way as to say, in neither case do we have a person who is acting out discipleship toward Jesus. Rather, he sees the centurion's statement, this was indeed the Son of God, as simply another statement about how courageously this man was dying. But that is not necessarily meant to say that the centurion was converted. On the contrary, that same centurion is the one who goes to Pilate to tell Pilate when Jesus is dead. So he's still part of the Roman system. And he says, early in the gospel, it was the evil spirits who were able to identify Jesus as the Son of God. So, big deal, the centurion identifies Jesus as the Son of God. Why do we pick that up and see that as an indication that the centurion has been converted? It's simply another time when the evil spirits are naming Jesus, and Jesus resists being named because in Hebrew lore that means to be controlled. The one who names controls the one who's being named. And he sees the centurion as, again, the Roman authorities trying to control and destroy Jesus and succeeding in doing that. And the centurion continues to be part and parcel of that crowd. Now, that's a different way than I've preached on that text. And Joseph of Arimathea, we've always seen him as this member of the Sanhedrin who, you know, really was secretively claiming the body of Jesus to honor the body. And Meyer says, that's not the way to read that. Here's a part of the Jewish powers that have always been pit against Jesus. And what Joseph is doing is getting rid of the body. He's
hiding it away.
He's getting it away, hiding it away as quickly as possible. And then he has this wonderful statement. I really like this. He says, "The one who claimed to be the Lord of the Sabbath," in the second chapter. Remember the Sabbath stuff that was going on. "The one who claimed to be the Lord of the Sabbath is subjected to the ultimate insult, an improper entombment for the sake of the Sabbath." That the body was not cared for at all. That's what the women went to do after the Sabbath was over. You're not supposed to do any extra work on the Sabbath. So here's the one who claimed to be the Lord of the Sabbath, who now becomes subject to, in the final insult,
the
as he puts it, the rules of the Sabbath. Yeah. And put away quickly so he can do the Sabbath thing and honor that which earlier Jesus said he was Lord of that whole thing. That's a little twist on it. I never preached that way on that text either.
You made me think of the very ending of, remember the film Amadeus?
Yeah.
When the great Mozart is dumped into the
pit. Yeah. Yeah, right. I hadn't thought about that. That's neat.
It just popped into my
head. Right, right. Well, I'm going to just read one final couple of sentences here from Myers in concluding our time together. He says, "The full revelation of the human one," that's the Son of Man, he's talking about, translation of that, "the full revelation of the human one has resulted in neither triumphal victory for the community, as the disciples had hoped, nor the restored Davidic kingdom, as the rebels had hoped, nor tragic failure and defeat, as we, the readers, have feared. It has resulted in nothing more and nothing less than the regeneration of the messianic mission. If we have eyes to see the advent of the human one, we will be able to see Jesus still going before us into Galilee. As the young man said to the women, tell the disciples to go to Galilee, back north, and it's going to start all over again."
Yeah, I always loved that image. I'm glad that you didn't take that one away. Of Jesus going ahead, so that we don't control him or contain him.
Yeah, right. And I've said earlier that's why Myers believes that the Gospel of Mark does indeed end with 16:8. These two additions that have been put on by another text, he thinks are not part of Mark's writing. The climax of the story is a young man telling the women, go tell the disciples to go to Galilee, that Jesus goes before them. Still going. And he has this whole circular thing. We're back to the disciples joining Jesus as they did at the very, very beginning of the gospel. However, the twist in that is that the women leave afraid and tell no one. So the story is left hanging. It's not a happy ending. It's not triumphalistic. It's the way of the cross. But to continue this quote, the invitation by Jesus, by way of the young man, to follow him to Galilee is the third and last call to discipleship. He evokes both hope and terror. Hope in that he who once joined in the naked shame of abandonment now stands in new attire at the tomb. Terror in that his new clothes are that of a martyr. Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
We got to the end of Mark. Isn't that something?